Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We're going to have a very in-depth and interesting program today. I stayed up late last night writing a commentary that I believe will give us some important new insights on what to make of the issues in America today, from the people running for president to what our own personal responsibility should be. I'll also be sharing some in-depth insights on the nature of fascism and oligarchy and personal responsibilities from one of the greatest thinkers on the planet, Professor Henry Giroux. I'm going to talk today about surrendering critical thought and what it means and how we can change that. Also today, we're going to talk about zinc and toxic air pollution, nanoparticles that are ending up in our brain from the University of Lancaster University in the United Kingdom, and how fenugreek extract can benefit if you have menopausal symptoms, and also a shingles vaccine. Well, that makes sense, right? Except with this shingles vaccine, you get shingles. Merck. Thank you, Merck. That makes a lot of sense. And then we're going to talk about mushrooms helping your microbiome and a landmark study. Boy, I've been waiting for this. Finally, it's out there. And I'm going to share this from Clara Burnish from the Free Thought Project. Quote, a landmark study shows half of cancer patients are killed by chemotherapy, not cancer. Half. Let's see, that'd be over 300,000 people a year dying. That means over the last 10 years, that's 30 million. So let's go back, 30 years. So what, 9 million, almost 10 million people killed? Does that qualify for paying attention? We'll discuss that, and you'll hear from a doctor, in fact, one of the most respected doctors in the state, talking about cancer treatments. So we have a lot to share, plus I'm going to be interrupting my commentaries to emphasize some things that are all connected, and I'll explain how they're connected as we go along. For example, have you ever wondered what it's like to be a soldier in Israel? Your conditioning, your belief system that would allow you to participate in the occupation of the Palestinian people. Well, we have one of those individuals today. So we're going to hear about how Israel trains its police forces in the occupied territories. Also, have you heard any of our secretaries of Treasury, any of our major members of Congress, with the exception of Ron Paul, when he was in Congress in the House, stand up and say our entire banking system is a scam? We have such a person, and he's going to talk in just a minute and 20 seconds, tell you what he thinks, and he's absolutely right on. The neocons and Clintonites, they want regime change in Syria. So we're going to take a look at what that means and why Hillary Clinton's war record matters at a time when Donald Trump is ramping up his fundraising efforts so he can spend more on the military. Why? Now, we all should know that Donald Trump has some serious personal issues. Forget all of his bankruptcies. Forget that he was a trust baby. Forget his dad gave him $200 million and supported the Ku Klux Klan. Forget all that for a moment. It's still there. This is a man who seems incapable of spending 20 seconds in introspective thought to understand how he is being used or allowing himself to be used by the neocons. When I saw the other day the person who's his military advisor, who is a super hawk, saying we need more troops and NATO and Russia is a threat and the Middle East, you knew where that was going to lead. So I'm going to give you some thoughts on that as well. We begin now because we have a lot to share. From the University of Auckland in New Zealand, zinc just a plain mineral, was found to reverse brain cell changes in autism. Quote, cellular changes in the brain caused by genetic mutations that occur in autism can be reversed by zinc. Medical scientists, University Department of Physiology, have researched aspects of how autism mutations change brain cell function over a five-year period. The latest project was also working with scientists in America and Germany, was published in the Journal of Neuroscience. So zinc, just by itself, can make a difference. So we have a lot of people listening right now all over the world whose children suffer from autism spectrum disorder. Now, it's not a miracle nutrient, and it's only one nutrient. We already know what methylated B12 at 1 milligram, methylated folic acid at 1 milligram. So let's just get ourselves some zinc at 20 milligrams and see if that helps. That study says yes. High-quality evidence suggests that vitamin D can reduce asthma attacks. This is from the Cochrane Database Collaboration. That's one of the most respected independent scientific groups in the world. And it says the following, that, well, we know that asthma is a common chronic disease affecting about 300 million people worldwide. And the symptoms, we've seen the wheezing, the coughing, the chest tightness, and shortness of breath. But low blood levels of vitamin D3 have been linked to increased risk of asthma attacks in children and adults with asthma. So there's now a lot of interest in what will vitamin D3 do if you have this. And we found that it will help reduce upper respiratory infections, like the common cold. And it will help with asthma. So make sure if you know anyone who has asthma, have them checked, a simple, inexpensive blood test for their vitamin D3 levels. If it's low, get them up to a normal level. And for women going through any form of menopausal symptoms, fenugreek, F-E-N-U, Greek, G-R-E-E-K, it's an extract, it's an herb, and a standard extract of fenugreek may reduce hot flashes in postmenopausal women and improve the quality of their life. This was published in the peer-reviewed Phytotherapy Research, and it indicated that hot flashes decreased by 48%, and that's terrific. So it also improved vaginal dryness, irritability, anxiety, night sweats, mood swings, insomnia, and headaches. How about that? All good. 1,000 milligrams for 90 days was found to, quote, offer hormonal balance by significantly enhancing the estradiol levels, and estradiol that was shown to play a key role in menopausal discomforts. Moreover, fenugreek supplementation for 90 days was found to be safe with no adverse effects as shown by the hematological and serum biochemical parameters. And this was a double-blind, placebo-controlled study. So think of all the women listening or men who have women in their lives who may be suffering from any of the hot flashes or irritability, anxiety, night sweats, mood swings. I mentioned one more way to help them. From Lancaster University, which is in the United Kingdom, tiny magnetic particles from air pollution have for the first time been discovered to be lodged in human brains. And researchers think they could be a possible cause of Alzheimer's disease. University of Lancaster, our scientists found abundant magnetites, nanoparticles, in the brain tissue from individuals young to old. This strongly indicated that neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. So where do you get these? Well, things like platinum, nickel, cobalt, these are all in the air in tiny particulate matter. You can't see them. One more reason to use proper air filtration systems. We're also right now being heard by a lot of cab drivers, bus drivers, even people at the airport. In fact, I just left Denver Airport, and as I was walking up early in the morning to get my ticket to go to the next stop in my filming journey, the man says, "One second, I'll be right with you." And he was doing something, and he looked up, and he says, hey, I'm listening to you on the radio. It was one of those funny moments. And he's, you're Gary Knowles. Yeah, he said, man, I listen all the time. Download your shows over the internet. And I'm looking around, I'm thinking, how many people in a day go into an airport, a subway, buses, stadiums, where it's very polluted, and you really don't have any way of cleaning up the air well? So by wearing either a little ionizer around your neck, small, nobody notices. I wear it every time I'm on a plane. It creates a protective barrier of around 12 inches around your head. And when the battery runs out after about 3 or 4 weeks, you can replace it or recharge it. But also in cabs and buses, you can actually put it into the cigarette lighter and you have it, and it's purifying the air in your cab or truck. Now think of how much particulate matter you're exposed to if you're driving in Manhattan. So for the health benefit of all the cab drivers, because you're in that cab all day long, an average of 12 hours, first you should be sitting on a magnetic cushion that protects your kidneys and your muscles. And you should also have a little hard rubber ball. And you should put that under your feet throughout the day when you stop and just roll from the ball of the foot down to the heel and back and forth for about a minute or two. And that helps preventing cramping in the leg. If you take magnesium, magnesium from citrate, along with calcium from citrate, and vitamin E, maybe twice a day, that helps prevent muscles from cramping, especially calf muscles. And some cayenne helps keep your blood circulating, because just visualize a water hose. When you put a crimp in it, it stops the flow. Now imagine your arteries and your veins. Veins coming back, bringing blood back, the venous blood supply, and arteries taking it down. When you bend your knees, like in your sitting, you cross your legs, which is really bad, you're putting a bind and adversely affecting circulation. And truck drivers, cab drivers, people who sit a lot, you have that problem. So first, let's clean up the air around you. Then let's help you prevent those cramps and increase your circulation. From the University of Nottingham, there's a fruit from the Asham Keping tree, Asamkaping, and it's now been shown to prevent atherosclerosis, our number one killer. That's the hardening and narrowing of the arteries. And that's good. This was done at their Malaysia campus, and it's a local fruit, very common. And so one more thing that we can look forward to, because it's been used there for a long time, not in the United States, but just keep in mind, it'll show up here sooner or later. And finally, cacao extract, which is chocolate, reduces wrinkles in this study. This is a Seoul National University in South Korea. Quote, oral supplementation with cacao extract could reduce ultraviolet B-induced wrinkles. The study published in the Journal of Investigative Dermatology noted that recent research has suggested that cacao consumption may be linked to beneficial effects for human health, and especially with the improved condition of the skin. Well, that's good news, especially for everyone who likes chocolate, but get the organic, healthy, dark chocolate. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health nutrition. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Walking through the park, it wasn't quite dark. There was a man sitting on a bench. Out of the crowd, as his head slowly bowed, he just moaned and it made no sense. He just go,
I'd like to welcome people from all over the world, all the different countries, all the different syndicated stations carrying this program, people listening over the telephone, people listening over any portable device, as well as people who are downloading this program from the internet. By the way, yesterday we had 56,000 at 7 o'clock at night. Not bad. I did a 1-hour commentary on the likely outcome if Hillary Clinton gets elected. I want to mention that this Saturday is the next to the last meeting of our health support group, ending 3 months of a very comprehensive study for anti-aging and a lot of conditions. So all of you who've been coming diligently and following the protocol, please be there 3 to 6 o'clock. Also, this coming Sunday, we have increased the length of our 9/11 special because we have some brand new information. In fact, I'm going out today to another location to film it and record it at 4 o'clock today. And so we are now up to between 7 to 8 hours. So we're going to start it at 6 p.m. this Sunday evening at the Progressive Radio Network. You can listen to it live. You can listen over the phone, or you can listen on the archives. But it's going to be a big, big to-do. If you want to listen live by any portable listening device, you call 424-203-8046, 424-203-8046. Or if you don't have time to listen then, and you just want to download it at your leisure after Sunday night, Monday morning, you can call 701-719-9976. That's 701-719-9976. This way you have three ways of listening: over the internet, over listening device, telephone, or downloading it later at your convenience. But it's going to be a historic show. You will not want to miss that. Also, we'd like to welcome over to the Progressive Radio Network, starting this evening, a new program for us, and it's a good program. It was on WBAI for 33 years, and I believe tonight's their last night. They were told they were no longer wanted on the air without any comment or personal interview, just a curt message. And so some people in the audience gave us a call. And it's the Computer Show. It'll be on at 6 o'clock tonight on the Progressive Radio Network, and we welcome them. And so people like computer shows, I believe tonight's the last night it's going to air. That's what we were told on BAI. Now for some insights and commentary. And then we have a lot of audio clips. So I'm not going to have time for talkback today because we're going to be packed. It is my belief that we can use the model presented by Professor Henry Giroux and others, Chris Hedges, that we are living in an authoritarian time. I believe we all are aware of that. We see how the militarization of our police, we have seen regime change around the world, we've seen meddling in foreign countries' affairs, currently in Venezuela, fomenting riots, and holding ourselves above the law. No matter what the law, the Geneva Convention, we're above it. In fact, we're never held accountable for any of our crimes and misdemeanors if we're in power. If you're not, that's a different matter. You never hear of people walking out of Wall Street and suddenly being shot in the back and tasered or stopped and frisked. In fact, you never hear about that from anyone in a position of power or their family unless they're a person of color. Different standard. So we try to hide the fact of how racist we are or how disconnected from the racist attitudes of other people are, as if as long as we're not doing it, we're not involved. And then there are those, myself included, who believe, yes, we do have a totalitarian police state that allows you to function, providing that as long as what you're doing and functioning and how you're living and making money does not in any way, shape, or form contravene the orthodox approach, the official approach. For example, if you're a physician and you're treating cancer patients and one day you decide, I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to use some natural non-toxic method because the approach that you've been using doesn't work. You know, you told my wife who had terminal breast cancer, she had to have radical mastectomy, then she had to have radiation and chemotherapy. She did. She trusted you. We trusted you. Then it came back. And there was nothing more there to operate on. And so you gave her more radiation chemotherapy. Now she's wasting away. And you say there's nothing more can be done. Here's some morphine. Take her to hospice care. I found this doctor down in Houston, Texas. and he was able to help her and save her life. But when I started to mention what he was doing, you were angry at me. And I'm thinking, why would you be angry? You had done the best you could, and we paid you over $300,000, and you said she was going to die. So if anything worked, why shouldn't I have an opportunity to try it, and why wouldn't you be supportive of that? Why are you only supportive of what you believe in, even if what you believe in doesn't work? Now, I'm going to ask my engineer to find the clip from this highly decorated police officer, one of the most decorated, police officer in his department. It's a short clip, but I want to give you an idea what it's like when you're inside the power paradigm, where you may be exercising what you consider the right way to police, but what happens when your wife or your kid gets a disease, and now you find out that, gee whiz, there is also very limited freedom of choice, and there's a great deal of authoritarian heavy-handedness in how you're treated and your kid's treated. And then there's another way. In any case, so from my perspective, we have a personal responsibility to begin to look at, do I willingly act as a passive spectator, living in a virtual reality to everything that's happening around me, where I can stay disconnected? Once in a while, something will happen that gets my attention or makes me feel a particular way. But by and large, I don't pay attention to the 27,000 children who are dying each 24 hours in the world. I don't pay attention to the people who are without water, the people who are just hit in Louisiana, who have nothing to go home to because their home was literally destroyed. I don't pay attention to the 7 million homes that were foreclosed on, the 30 million people who were put out on the street with their belongings in the yard, and they got 2 hours to get out of the house or they'll get arrested. I don't pay attention to the million homeless vets and those also with Gulf War syndrome, neurological damage, chronic fatigue syndrome. I don't pay attention to which wars we get into, how much it costs, who the casualties are. I don't pay attention to who exploits whom in Haiti in an earthquake. I don't pay attention to who donates to Clinton's foundation or any other foundation. None of these things impact me. Because as long as I'm able to distract myself and keep myself occupied, my life is at least tolerable. And then we get to the larger picture. You see, we've been talking about what happens if Clinton gets elected, what happens if Trump gets elected, what happens if Gary Johnson gets elected. Do you really think they're the problem? They're only one part of the problem, in my opinion. I believe that the greater problem is the individual not being able to use critical thought to understand what is in their own best interest. Now, this brings me over to Marjorie Cohen. Many people in this audience know her. And she says that Orwell, George Orwell of 1984 fame, never could have imagined the National Security Agency would amass metadata on billions of our phone calls and 200 million of our text messages every 24 hours. Orwell could not have foreseen that our government would read the content of every single email, every single file transfer, and every single live chat from social media we use. Now, Edward Snowden and Marjorie Cohen and other critics are correct about the dangers of the state's infringement of privacy rights. But their analysis should be taken further by linking the issue of citizen surveillance with the rise of networked societies. What do I mean by network societies? That means global flows of power. In the emergence of a totalitarian ethos that defies even state-based control. Now, for George Orwell, domination was state-imposed and bore the heavy hand of unremitting repression and a smothering language that eviscerated any appearance of dissent or erased all historical memory. If I ask you, do you know about the Maddox, the United States ship that was intentionally sunk by the Israelis in in our present time, a complete sociopath, Lyndon Johnson, covered it up. Why? But it's no longer in our historical memory. And the truth that is turned always in its opposite. For Orwell, individual freedom was at risk under the heavy hand of state terrorism. But let's be practical. The average American is not broke. The average American has at least $500,000 in assets. If we're talking about average, those who are the professional class, those who have graduate degrees, accountants, lawyers, engineers, the entrepreneurial class, of which you have anywhere between 8 to 10 million, and those upper middle class retirees who live conservatively, they didn't spend more than what they have, and they didn't take a lot of risks, they worked hard, and we've got over 40 million of them. So when you add up how many Americans actually have savings, haven't been arrested, are not being profiled, no SWAT team is knocking on their door saying, you know, is such and such here, she owes a bill, and they don't have to concern themselves with debtors' prisons or unsafe water to drink or walking down mean streets, they will never in their life probably see a ghetto. They have removed themselves from people's suffering. They're the ones who can sit and watch everything but will not become involved. To the degree they become involved, they only become involved in a virtual state of passive safety. They'll listen to a figure on the radio or television who represents some of their feelings of what's wrong, and it's generally very black and white. But they're one part of it. For other people, oh, they do feel the heavy hand of authority. They would know exactly what Orwell was discussing. In Orwell's world, individual freedom and privacy were under attack from outside forces. However, more salient to me today is Aldous Huxley, because in contrast, freedom and privacy were willingly given up as part of the seductions of a soft authoritarianism, with its vast machinery and manufactured needs and desires and identities. This new mode of persuasion seduced people into chasing commodities and infantilized them through the mass production of easily digestible entertainment and disposable goods. Everything was obsolescence. And new scientific advances in which any viable sense of agency was undermined. The conditions for critical thought completely dissolved into the limited pleasures of instant gratification wrought through the use of technologies and consuming practices that dampened, if not obliterated, the very possibility of thinking itself. Orwell's dark image is the stuff of government oppression, and we see it. How many times have you had to look at something and say, why would the cop come to the door and kill a little dog that represented no threat? Why, when the person was on the ground, hands in the air, no gun, would they shoot him surrounded by seven armed cops? Why? So that's the Orwell's dark image. But far more insidious today is Huxley. Because with Huxley, he said, look for the distractions, the diversions, the transformation of privacy into a cheap and sensational performance for public display. It was Neil Postman, writing in a different time and worried about the destructive anti-intellectual influence of television, sided with Huxley and believed that repression was now on the side of entertainment and the propensity of American public to amuse itself to death. Now, his attempt to differentiate Huxley's dystopian vision from Orwell's is worth noting. You see, Orwell warns that we will be overcome by an externally imposed oppression. But in Huxley's vision, no big brother is required to deprive people of their autonomy, maturity, and history. As he saw it, people will come to love their oppression, to adore the technologies that undo their capacities to think. What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. Yeah. Well, Huxley feared what was there would be no reason to ban a book because nobody would want to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us too much information that would be reduced to passivity and egotism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with some equivalent of the feelies, the orgy-porgy, the centrifugal nonsense. As Huxley remarked in Brave New World Revisited, and I hope you read it, the civil libertarians and the rationalists who are ever on the alert to oppose tyranny failed to take into account man's almost infinite appetite for distractions. In 1984, Huxley added, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In the Brave New World of Huxley, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure or escaping pain. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us. They were both right. Echoes of Huxley's insight play out in the willingness of millions of people to voluntarily hand over personal information, whether in the service of a strange society prompted by social media or in homage to the new surveillance state. New surveillance technologies, one of which I mentioned on yesterday's program, where every single new television and computer is looking back at you, can turn itself on when you think it's off. You're not aware it's recording you, your audio and video. Would you want someone to know all of your thoughts? Because they're not going to collect these thoughts unless they have an agenda. And their agenda is never a peaceful one or a benevolent one. And yet now they have what they need, if they need to control you. So that's what we're up to. And the new surveillance technologies employed by major service providers now focus on diverse consumer populations who are targeted in the collection of endless amounts of personal information as they move from one site to the next, one geopolitical region to the next, and across multiple screens and digital apparatuses. You see, society is there so social media can give us what we think is liberating and freeing. It's just the opposite. Every time we express our liberty and freedom, someone else is taking that into account. Is this represent a threat? Indeed, surveillance technologies are now present in virtually every public and private space. Video cameras in streets, commercial establishments. There's audio equipment on all over every city, so when you're walking down the street, you're being recorded. Workplaces, even in schools, as well as myriad scanners at entry points at airports, retail stores, sporting events, and so on. They function as control mechanisms that can become normalized through their heightened visibility. People then forget why they're there. At the same time, Orwell warned about Big Brother applying not simply an authoritarian surveillance state, but also a commanding financial institutions and corporations to have exactly what they want done, and nowhere else will it be done. In other words, whatever they want, that's what you're going to get, and nothing more. I'm concerned about this. I'm concerned that we're not paying attention to the authoritarian state and how much of our own personal liberties and rights we've given away. For that, I want you now to listen to a gentleman who's going to tell you what it means to be a part of a surveillance state, a control state, an Orwellian and a Huxley state, and then one day to wake up. This is an ex-Israeli soldier speaking about Israel. Listen in, please.
My name is Eran Eflati. I'm 28 years old. I'm from Jerusalem, born and raised in Jerusalem. I'm in actually seventh generation in Jerusalem. My grandpa was born in the old city. He was a fifth generation in Jerusalem. He was born in the middle of the old city in the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem. His mother died in birth. A Palestinian neighbor took him in and breastfed him. So he was actually a Palestinian Jew. This is how he knew himself. He grew up knowing Arabic before he knew Hebrew. All of his friends were Palestinians and some Jewish people that was there around him. My grandpa, from my father's side, that was born there, passed away 2.5 weeks ago in Jerusalem, in his home. And Maya and me were debating if I should go back to the Shiva, the wheel in our religion of the 7 days of mourning. And I was talking with my father, asking him if I should go back. And me and Maya talked, and we decided that it's much more important for me, at least, to continue to do this lecture in his memory. Because today, so many people today cannot imagine the possibility of Jews and Palestinians living together. on the same piece of land, although my grandpa was the living proof of it already happened a lot before Israel was established. So this is from my grandpa. So, hi, I grew up in Jerusalem in a very Zionist militaristic family, like most of the families in Jerusalem or in Israel altogether. Most of the families are Zionist. I guess you were aware of that, except for maybe the ultra-Orthodox Jews. They are a very different species than all of us. But we are all grew up as Zionists. I grew up knowing that being a Zionist, meaning being a Jew, it's the exact same thing. And being anti-Zionist or don't want to be a Zionist, meaning being an anti-Semitic. Hating all the Jews. If you're anti-Zionist, you want all the Jews to die. This is how I grew up at home. I grew up in a very militaristic home. My only brother, my older brother, was an officer in a special unit of the paratroopers in Israel. My mother was an officer in the Israeli army, and my father was a very high officer in the Israeli army. And until today, he's the head of investigation of the Jerusalem police. So, so I'm coming from a good legacy in my family. I grew up in my home in Jerusalem with my grandma and grandpa from my mother's side as well. And they came from Hungary after the Holocaust. And they were the only survivors of their family after the Holocaust. My grandma was an Auschwitz survivor. In a very early age, I grew up understanding that there's something wrong with the world because I saw my grandma and how she reacted to things, you know, with a lot of fear, with a lot of paranoia back at home. One of my first childhood memories was waking up in the middle of the night from screaming. My grandma used to wake up screaming in the middle of the night. She had dreams on Auschwitz, on the Holocaust, and all of the house would wake up very terrified, and my mom used to run into my room, me and my brother's room, and will calm us down and will explain to us, you know, why is grandma screaming? What is Auschwitz? What is the Holocaust? Why did they do it to the Jews? And I grew up knowing that I want to be a better human being. I grew up knowing that something so terrible happened. So the next time something like that happens, something terrible in history will happen, I will be there on the right place at the right time. I want to be this kind of man. I grew up starting to want to know everything I can about the Holocaust to make sure it can never happen again in any way. So I grew up, and except for learning in school about what happened to the Jews, like all of the guys in school, I started to read about the Nazis. How would soldiers would go out in the morning to camps and go back in the afternoon or night to their families to tuck down their little babies, to kiss their wife? That would drive me crazy. I read Mein Kampf when I was 15 years old. I became very, very much involved in the story of the Holocaust. And in the 11th grade, like most of my friends, like most of the people in Israel, I would find myself in a delegation on my way to Poland. I don't know, you can't see it really well, right? I don't know what you can do about the lights, but this is us in Auschwitz doing a trip of 2 weeks in, oh great, thank you. In all the camps, don't fall asleep. In all the camps in Poland, every school in Israel sent their kids to do that. And after 2 weeks of going from camp to camp, the last camp was Auschwitz. This is Birkenau. And the last camp was Auschwitz. And I'm standing in the same camp that my grandma survived. And in some point, I'm standing in the same hut that my grandma used to sleep in. And exactly in that moment, and it was a very emotional moment for me, I'm getting a letter. The letter was from my grandma. My grandma wrote me a letter, and my mom sneaked into the delegation through my guides. And I'm getting the letter, and the letter says, well, Eran, you're such a sweet boy, and you have such a big heart, and you're so sensitive, but I'm afraid that maybe you're too sensitive. It's very important to know everything you can about the Holocaust, that's for sure. You have to learn about that. But the Holocaust was not your fault. You don't need to take it upon yourself. You don't need to feel that you're a bad person because it happened, or the world is a bad place. It's fine. Don't take it upon yourself anymore. I'm worried about you. It was the most sensitive and sweet letter I could get exactly at that moment. And I decided to read it to my friends. And the minute I finished the letter, one of my guides came up to me and said, well, Eran, you know what your grandma really wanted to tell you in the letter, right? I said, yeah, sure, that I'm a very sweet boy and I got a very big heart and I'm so nice. I said, no, what your grandma really wanted to tell you is that a second Holocaust will happen. And it will happen sooner than you think. And if you don't want to take it upon yourself that a second Holocaust has happened and you didn't do anything about it, you need to go back home, finish your school, and join the best unit you can in the military to make sure that a second Holocaust will never happen. Not to your grandma's sakes, not to your sakes, on your kids' sakes, you have to do it. Okay. I said, fine, this is what my grandma wants. And then I went back home and I finished my school and I'm joining the IDF as a combat soldier. This is me, a young, handsome soldier, and the IDF, I don't understand why people are laughing when I'm showing the picture. I was a very young and handsome soldier in the IDF. And I'm joining the IDF and immediately being sent to boot camp. And boot camp was basically 7 months of training for a war. For 7 months, every day, we were training for a war. A war with Egypt, a war with Syria, with Lebanon, with Iran. For 7 months, every day. But I guess it's a little confusing now because, you know, Israel was not in a war in the last 40 years. Since 1973, Israel did not perform in a war in front of another army, another country, with airplanes, with tanks. We did operations in what we called, occupied land or terrorist group with Hamas in Gaza or with Hezbollah in Lebanon. But we were not performing in a war. But nonetheless, all we did was getting trained for a war. And throughout the 7 months, not once we talked about Palestinians. And when the 7 months was over, I was sent to a very different kind of war. I was sent to Palestine. And I find myself in the biggest Palestinian city in the West Bank, in south of Palestine, called Hebron, or El Halil in Arabic. And I'm standing in a city of 180,000 Palestinians, and right in the heart of the city, in the middle of the city, there's a Jewish settlement. A settlement of 800 settlers, Jewish settlers, and around them there's 500 soldiers like me, and there's 300 policemen like my dad at the time. So why do we have to have police and army at the same place? Well, basically because we have two different kind of people. We have Jewish settlers that, although they're outside of the official borders of Israel, they are Israeli citizens. And they're getting all the perks of being an Israeli citizen, like letting the police handle their business, like any one of you. But then just next to them, next house, next door, next street over, there's the Palestinians. And they're, of course, not citizens of any states. And they're under our rule, under our 18, 19, 20 years old military law. And we are controlling their life. And very fast, I will understand what my job is in Hebron. My job is to make sure that everybody in the city understand who calling the shots. It's us, the army, and the Jewish settlers around us. And very fast during my job, I noticed something I really find it hard to understand. I had the power to close a complete city down. I would just have to walk down in the street and scream something like curfew. And everybody would close their shops and run to their home. Do you know what curfew is, or what the difference between a curfew and a closure? So you know that closure, for example, is on a city. If the Jewish, the Israeli army, I'm sorry, is performing a closure on a city because there's a Jewish holiday or a Jewish special Shabbat or a special day in Israel, we just do a closure or a curfew. So a closure is on a city, like Gaza or like Ramallah or any other city. You close up the city completely hermetically, and then nobody can go in and out from the city. But a curfew is something a bit different. A curfew is everyone to his home. When I'm screaming curfew, everybody runs to their home and closing their door until a second notice. Meaning if right now the Israeli army will step outside and scream curfew, and we are all here right now, you know, make yourself comfortable because we're stuck together. And it already in the past was, you know, a few days or a few hours or a week or a few months of curfew happening. And very fast in my service, I would start doing curfews. And one Shabbat, I had a weekend, it was a special weekend in the Jewish Bible, in the Jewish tradition. It's the piece of the Bible when Abraham is buying the Petra tombs in Hebron. So it's a special holiday for the Jewish settlers in Hebron. And there's thousands of settlers from all over the West Bank coming to the Hebron to do this weekend. And there's a lot of Israelis, thousands of Israelis coming from Israel to Hebron to doing this weekend. It's a very special weekend. And of course, all the 180,000 Palestinians of the city have to go to curfew. So we're calling the curfew, and then we're getting a backup for that weekend alone of another unit. It's a special unit that specializes in terrorism. And in this unit, I have a very good friend from back home. And I'm seeing this friend, it's so funny, you know, it's so nice to meet a friend from back home in the middle of Hebron. And we want to speak, but we never have the chance because I'm doing all the day shifts of making sure that everybody is in their home, a curfew is being down, and he's doing all the night shift. So we're just missing each other every time. And the last night of the weekend, I'm telling him, okay, tonight when I'm coming back, we're going to sit for like 5 minutes, do a cigarette, a coffee, and you just tell me what's going on at home, what's going on with your girlfriend, saying, okay, we promise. And I'm coming back from the day shift, and he's just about to leave to the night shift, and we don't have any time again. So we're saying, okay, in the morning, and my friend is going to the night shift, and I'm going to sleep. And after a few hours of sleep, not a lot, I'm being woken up very hardly. And I open my eyes as my friend is leaning over me in the bed. And I'm asking him, what's going on? And my friend is just mumbling. And I'm looking outside and I see that half of his unit came back already a few hours earlier from the night shift. And his unit is in the base, and but they're divided completely. Half of his unit is completely celebrating. You know, they're like going into the kitchen at 4 a.m. to get something to eat and they're singing. But half of the unit is just going around in the base and they look like, you know, they're in shock. They're completely stunned. So I'm starting asking my friend, what is going on? What is going on? And my friend is looking at me and saying, well, I think we just killed a little boy. I'm saying, what? What do you mean you think you just killed a little boy? It's this kind of thing you need to know. And my friend is telling me, I'm not sure. We were out there in the middle of the shift and we saw someone. We saw a figure out in the dark and he was holding something. And so we just start screaming at him, curfew, and one of the guys just started shooting. So all of us just start shooting. And he just fell. And we walked beside him and we noticed it's very small. So we just came back to the base. I had no idea what do I supposed to do with this information. I was 19. I was a few months in Hebron, and I didn't know the answer. So the best thing I could say at that moment was, okay, let's get some sleep. I will wake up with you early in the morning, and we can go together to that house, and we'll see what happened, and maybe we can apologize. And I was a very naive young soldier, because a few hours later, very early, before we had a chance to wake up, our officers came into the room and waked all the base up. All the base should be on their feet with their uniform and a helmet and grenades and ammunition and M16 getting ready to go out for a mission. Nobody knows what's going on, but the two units is getting up and getting ready and leaving the base and start marching with first light in Hebron into the Abu Snena neighborhood of Hebron. And my friend who is in the other unit is looking at me and saying, this is the neighborhood we were last night. I'm telling him, great, the minute we'll finish the mission, I'm going with you to that house, I promise. And we're going into the neighborhood and we're going into a street. And my friend is looking at me and saying, this is the street when we were last night. And we're going down the street and we're just stopping in front of a house. And we're getting orders to surround the house. And my friend is looking at me and saying, this is the house we were last night. And we're just standing there around the house for 20 minutes to understand what's going on. And after 20 minutes, we understand there's a funeral of a little boy supposed to come out from the house to the cemetery in Abu Snena neighborhood. But there's a curfew. There's a Jewish holiday. Nobody can leave their house. So our mission is to make sure that the funeral cannot go out of the house to the cemetery. And we're just standing there for minutes and minutes on, until the father of the little kid is going outside of his house and starts screaming at us. And he's screaming at us, and at some point he's pushing one of the officers away. And that's really something you cannot do in Palestine. You cannot push an officer away. So we just did what we do with everyone doing something he doesn't supposed to do in Palestine. We arrest him. And it's always the same way. It doesn't matter if he's, you know, 85 years old or he's 80 years old. It's always the same way. We have a little piece of plastic in our weapon, and we're just tying him behind his back very tightly. We have a piece of fabric in our weapon, just blindfold him. And just taking the father and throwing him into the military jeep. And the mother of the kid that was killed, seeing that we just arrested her husband, is getting outside of the house. And she starts screaming at us. And she's screaming at us and screaming at us and screaming at us. It was so deep that all of a sudden I understood that I already heard this screaming before. She was screaming exactly like my grandma used to wake us up with every night when I was a kid. And I didn't know a word in Arabic. I didn't understand what she's saying, but I understood everything that she meant in her screaming. And I just couldn't handle her screaming, so I just volunteered to take the father to the base to arrest him. And I just jumped into the jeep and just drove away. And we got to the base and I just put the father in the entrance of the base like we did with most of the people that we arrested. And I just went back to my bed and put the blanket over my head and tried to make it go away. But it didn't.
What you're listening to is just the beginning of what will be a four-part series to show you that there are realities that exist in this world because people who have power don't care about the consequences to others. and what happens when one day they wake up and realize the significance of that. Not just regaining a sense of critical thought, but critical emotional connection to that which is essential in life. And just one more thought when it comes to the power to give away your rights without being aware that people are using this against you. Many individuals, especially young people, now run from privacy and increasingly demand services in which they can share every personal facet of their lives. And while Orwell's vision touched upon this type of control, there is a notable difference that we now foresee. And that is that historically, Orwell's thought police tracked you without permission. Today, we voluntarily give permission to have every part of our lives examined, scrutinized, taken apart, because we only appreciate the cultural commodification of our addictions through self-help therapies, social connections. That's what we're connected to today. And the people on the other end, whether it's Bank of America or Disney or in a National Security Agency or the FBI or all these other agencies, Facebook, Yahoo, Google, Apple, they're all Microsoft, they're all a part of this. They're all interconnected. So both Huxley was right. You must be concerned about the heavy hand of the totalitarian state. But Huxley was also right, and that how much of your health, your insight, your intuition do you give away and replace with this morphing of utopian ideals? That if you have a crisis in life, why deal with it? Take a pill. If your kid is being told they need to be vaccinated, rush them to be vaccinated with every possible vaccine, but don't question it. Because you see, you can't do both. You can't engage in critical thought and be concerned about the choices you make, and at the same time, trust authority. Because what is missing today in society that has led us to have such loathsome choices as a Trump or a Clinton or a Obama or a George Bush or Ronald Reagan? We have abrogated all of our power to the figures of authority, to the levels of our educational status, to those people who have created a professional status that we always abdicate to a medical industrial complex, to an educational system that is perverse, food producers that give us toxic foods, and of course elected officials that have no ethics whatsoever. We believe in the illusion of American exceptionalism, that no country could be better, no God more sincere, and yet it is all an illusion. By surrendering critical thought, we surrender reason, and that leads to a further distancing of innate, intuitive, and instinctual facilities. Decisions based upon irrational emotions that people will delude themselves into believing are instincts and intuition. For example, the mother who intuits not to have her kid vaccinated, not to allow them to eat sugar, not to have them have fructose in the diet, but goes ahead and allows them to eat the junk, get the vaccines, based upon an irrational emotion that trumpeted her initial intuition. So surrender the unique parental role in education, and you're leaving it to the schools, to the teachers, to the experts, and their interest is not necessarily the same as your child. Surrendered trust in ourselves, surrendered trust in the universe around us, creates a fear-based emotional reaction that kids can't be kids. They must be chaperoned, overly protected, micromanaged, because the world is too dangerous. Kids are forced to surrender, therefore, their inquisition, their explorative minds, to engage with a larger world. We have suspicions of everything, which causes the breakdown in of our relationships and community building. We surrender deeper relationships due to fearful suspicions, and surrender the values to be gained from simplicity and hardship for luxury with as many healthy risks, and surrender deeper spiritual moral values, those represented by Gandhi, Martin Luther King, or Malcolm X, or Oscar Romero, capitulates us from concerted action, protects and the engagement of the so-called good, at least in Plato's sense, surrender our inner compass is what we do. That inner compass is there to coordinate ourselves in time and space, and that leads to the denial of our mortality. And hence we waste time on nonsense. So every day we're surrendering true spiritual individualism for faux individualism based upon primitive egocentric needs. We're using our reptilian brains, because only a reptilian brain could vote for any of the candidates today except for Jill Stein. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.